interview with Dr. William Royce, interviewer for Mosaic Mat, Washington, D.C., 11th January, 1991.
Okay, Mr. Royce, why don't you begin with a little bit of background, your educational background, and how you began your work with the United States government?
Okay. Really, the first thing I'd like to start out with, which ties in mostly with my connection with education in Iran, and really my connection with Iran outside of government is much more extensive than with government, but I will touch on that. The question almost anyone who I've run across, you know, tends to ask people like me, who are Americans who are involved with whatever Middle East country or foreign country, in this case Iran, is how did you get involved, how did you get started? My case is certainly an improbable one. My involvement was totally by accident. It was nothing like so many of sort of my generation of Americans who got into Iran sort of by going to, let's say, Peace Corps first or even Foreign Service first. When I got involved in Iran was my freshman year as an undergraduate was at the Foreign Service School at Georgetown University here in Washington. I came from New Jersey, where I'd grown up, and going to high school, and it was a whole new environment. I knew I was sort of vaguely interested in some sort of international career, wasn't sure what. I'm not sure I am even today. But in any case, as it happened, I got to know a student. Actually, he wasn't my roommate the first year, a student who came from Iran. In those days, this is 1961, there really, as you know yourself, relatively few Iranian students in the States. It was nothing like what happened, let's say, 10 years later in the early 70s. At Georgetown, it turned out in those days there were about, if I remember, maybe three Iranian students in the Foreign Service School and the Institute of Languages who was with us. I got to know, we were in classes, seemed very pleasant, was a guy called Hossein Nafisi. And we got to become very good friends. And I remember that first year during, I guess, Thanksgiving, we invited him up to New Jersey. And then over the Christmas holidays, Christmas vacation, we invited him to our home in New Jersey. Actually, we went from New Jersey to Chicago, where my mother's family lived, and so he had a chance to see a bit of the country and a variety of things. We got to know each other very well, and toward about April, I suppose, he suggested, well, he said, you know, my father had, thought it was very nice of you to invite me and so forth, so what we propose is this. Would you like to, if you can pay your way, we can put you up, and my father can get you a job teaching English at Iran American Society in Tehran. And so, would you be interested? I talked it over with my parents. There was no way the money I was going to earn teaching wouldn't cover the airfare, but my parents helped me out, so I said, okay, I'll take you up on this.
What year was this?
This was 1962 now. As you see, we met in the academic year that started in 1961. Now we're going at the end of the first year. And so we flew by, actually Hossein, something came up, and he had came out a little later. I went a little earlier, and went out there in the summer of 1962 and arrived in around midnight, I remember, in Tehran Airport. In many ways, I was lucky to have had such a long involvement in two things I was really lucky in, I think, getting perception about Iran, or three things, and I might interject this here. One is that I was able sort of continuously over a very long period to be familiar with the country. The Iran in 1962 was so different from Iran of 1968. which was even so much more different than 1974, these three periods when I was there, socially, economically, politically. The whole thing was very different. I was very lucky in two other ways. One is this long scope. The second, that I was able, you know, from the beginning, because my initial connection was a personal relationship, not an official or business, that from the beginning I got to know Iranian families and sort of the family setting, as opposed to the formal setting that all Iranians, you know, except really those who are married to, all Americans except those who really married to Iranians don't get into. And third, and I think a lot of this was due to efforts and plannings of my friend's father, who was a host, that from early on I was able to meet all kinds of people.
What was his father's name?
I'll get to that in one second. This is just a quickie, okay? But the third thing was that I was able to, from the beginning, to meet and get to know all kinds of Iranians, educated inside, educated outside, non-educated, farm people, city people, which again was sort of an opportunity that a lot of foreigners in Iran haven't had and don't have. Okay, now, a lot of this had to do, or a lot of the success of this first trip and my interest had to do with this friend of mine's father, because this friend of mine's father was a man called Habib Nafisi, who was very much involved in, who was, I'll say, a very strange bird, as Iranians go. He had was one of the Iranians who was sent abroad during Reza Shah to either Montpellier or Toulouse in France. He studied engineering. Then, before coming back to Iran, he thought he decided he wanted to go to the States. So he came to the States, and very unlike what lots of Iranians abroad did from sort of an educated background or a fairly well-off background, was that he got a job as a factory worker in an automobile factory. And that sort of gives you a very strange bird. Now, he was very, very strong personality, rather domineering type, but practically everything he did was an experiment. So in a way, for better or for worse, I was an experiment. Now, at the time, I thought it was sort of a pain, but because I became aware of this very early on, because you know, I found that this first trip, when I was pretty strictly under his control, that you know, that things were very well planned, but the planning sort of worked. Now, in those days, in the early 60s, as I said, Iran and Tehran was very different from Tehran of what I knew later. It turned out that something had come up, and Hossein, who was supposed to be there too, didn't show up until the last month of the 3 months. So I was on my own for the first 2 months. My routine was this. Well, I taught at Iran-America Society, which at that time was in Khiabon HaShah. And David Nall, who's now here in Washington, was the head of that. He was a Foreign Service officer and was very helpful to me then, and really has always continued to be very helpful to me. I thought he was really one of the most impressive U.S. government people I've ever met. Involved with Iranian things. In any case, so what happened was, since Hossein wasn't here, Nafisi felt that, you know, being put into an Iranian family immediately might be too stressful, so he found an American family, an American with AID whom he knew, and I, who lived very close to where he lived, where Nafisi lived, and I stayed with them. And my routine was this. I guess the first day he drove me down. Before I go on a bit, I'd said earlier that one thing that's always surprised me is life in the early 60s was so different from life even the late 60s or the early 70s, at least the life I saw. In life in the early 60s, most people who could afford it moved out of, most people I knew, and regarded all sorts of economic stuff, had winter places in Tehran and summer places to the north of Tehran. And almost everyone seemed to, they would pack up in late spring and move back when school started. This was a routine. Even amongst the quite wealthy ones, or at least the ones with old families, and the Shemron places at that time were pretty primitive. Primitive is an exaggeration, but it was nothing like the marble and plasterwork and all the glitter of the late 60s and the 70s and late 70s. And it was a very strange and different environment. Some people just more or less camped out. In any case, in Efesis, had a place. It had a swimming pool. It was nice in Shemron, but really quite simple. And we used to, and the place I stayed was close by with this American family. So the first day he drove me down, I went to Run America Society. They were very helpful. I'd never taught English before, but I managed. But again, as I said, Mr. Nafisi had quite a few things planned for him. But one thing he thought that, I think 3 days a week I was to have lunch at the Polytechnic, which he was the head of at the time. And that was very, very interesting because, I was in lunch with the students, so I got to meet, very often I suppose students he wanted me to meet, but students who were, tended to be, I suppose, middle class, quite a few provincial students. I got to know a lot of these people quite well. Again, he always, make sure that the ones I was with, he approved of one way or another.
What was your impression of the attitude of you met?
Well, I said one of the most interesting things, I've taught this framework of changes in the three periods. The change in the early 60s, this was the summer of 62. This is between, now people were still talking about in 60 or 61, when Iqbal was president of the university, there was trouble with Tehran University, right?
Right.
So this was still very much alive, and I would say very much in the early 60s.
This was during Adam's premiership, right?
Yeah, this is, no, it's during Dr. Amini. When I was there, it was Dr. Amini.
1962.
When I was there with Dr. Amini. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Amini was somehow related to my host, so, I got to know Dr. Amini going way back then. And his son, I got to know them quite well.
In that period?
Yeah. And because this Nafisi's sister or aunt or something was married to, no, his uncle was married to Amini's sister, which is relatively close, in these situations. So in any case, as I said, the one thing that struck me at the early 60s was the students were extremely politicized. They were extremely politicized. People would openly talk about democracy and against the Shah, not so much about Mossadegh, really, but just against the dictatorial government, against Savak. If I remember correctly, this was shortly before this. Remember, on the pretext of illegal elections, the Majlis had been closed.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so it was a period when people really talked about these things. Now, in that period, people didn't really talk about the 2-day too much. because I think there was very, as you know, there was very strong control. They came down hard, let's put it this way, in the early 60s about people with Soviet connections. Your groups like the sort of armed struggle groups had not yet materialized. Generally, it was this loose thing of the National Front. Nobody quite realized what it was, except it probably was better than what they thought it was better than what they had. Bazargan was emerging then. Not so much, though I remember people like Nafisi used to making jokes about him, and his fanaticism when they were students. You know, they used to say he used to go down to the River Seine and fill his aftabe because it had to be from Abekur and stuff like that. But other than that, the interest in Bazargan centered a lot around just more his democratic side and his goodness than his Islam. I don't remember his Islamic side being so in conversation. If you remember, in that when Iqbal was one thing that they talked a lot about Bazargan, and I'm putting these details, I think this is just if you're interested.
Sure.
One of the things that struck people about Bazargan then was when. And I remember Nafisi was very opposed to what they did when Iqbal was president of the university. And this is, I don't know when this was, 60 was it, or 61?
President,
and they had some riots at the university, and they came down very hard on the students.
That was before
it was pretty brutal. It was before 61.
Yeah,
I think about 60, maybe.
Yeah, even earlier.
Okay.
Because 60.
Well, people were still talking about
56,
this.
56.
Well, people were still talking about this that far back. And I remember a lot of people said that Bazargan, who was a professor at the time, I believe was arrested for a short time after this thing in the early 60s or late 50s. Protected students, hid students, So anyway, the thought amongst the students was quite, the students at the Polytechnic was quite, I'd say, pro-democratic, unsatisfied. There was a lot of ferment. The thing that was interesting, people talked about politics. When I came back in 1968, the atmosphere was extremely more oppressive. People were much more reluctant to talk about anything of substance until they knew you were pretty sure of you. But it was just a totally different thing. Now, of course, what intervened was the Punta Jordan, which changed lots of things. Right. Mm-hmm. Okay, so then other days at lunch. Okay, what I'm doing is giving you a little bit of my the various environments, variety of environments I found myself mixed up in, which is really quite a shock coming from where I was coming from. Maybe 3 days a week I had lunch at Polytechnic, which was, Rémy Polo and cutlet with no meat. But it was fun and good.
Cutlet with no meat?
Yeah, sort of Iranian. I'm sure there was little, but...
Shami.
Yeah, you know what I mean. But then 2 weeks, 2 days a week, he had this strange idea. I guess he thought that 5 days a week at the Polytechnic would be too much. So 2 days a week, he was somehow involved, I don't know if he was on the board or what, with this French club, where Mr. Bakhtiar was very involved, the former prime minister. So 2 days a week then, he had privileges where I could go and go for a swim at the Faransé club and have lunch and meet sort of the right sort of people there, and so I'd have a broad view. Then the third type of people I came in contact with were my students at Iran America site, which were a very broad range, ranging from sort of intermediate English, from maybe third year high school kids up to 60-year-old wives of former ministers who had been abroad. So it was a fascinating thing. Also, the teachers were very interesting. Many of the teachers were wives, American wives of Iranians, who had been the teachers, other than, let's say, myself, were really, and a couple, you know, professional teachers who traveled out, were a different type. One, the females, as I said, were, except for one or two Iranian women who had been very well educated in the States, were American wives of Iranians, some already divorced who had chose to stay. Many, some with positive, some with very negative attitudes about Iran and Iranians, and particularly Iranian family life and social structure, attitude toward women. That was very interesting for me. The men, three or four Iranian men, were again a very different group, where I'd say very talented, very sensitive guys who were really fish out, you know, who were Iranians who'd been abroad a long time and never quite fit back. One went on, I guess, to be a fairly successful actor. Another one always sort of played at being a poet. You must know this guy because he was in Medellin and he was a palace, Adib Sultani, an economist. You don't know him?
Adib Sultani.
Yeah, I mean, he didn't... Here's someone says his brother was one of these guys. But anyway, so that was the third group. The students were very interesting. Now, I found, you know, as one would expect, the students more my age, and I suppose I was about 19 or 20 when I was really quite young when I said this, were very anxious to get to know me and invite me and so forth. So, of course, all of this had to be sort of the Fridays I wasn't doing something with Mr. Nafisi, these 2 months before.
This period was after your college.
No, it's my first year of college.
First year of college.
Yeah. Summer of first year of college. I met him at my first year of college. Because in some ways this first trip is one of the early, most interesting. That's why I'm sort of getting into some of them. Maybe help you in later encounters to ask different questions. So I got to know some of these students very well, and they're really very different groups. Now, one group that I had been a constant recurring thing always is that always when I was teaching, one sort of students that would try to get, you know, really, they would say try to get, would be very friendly, hospitable, always invite me, and this goes back to this period, are students who are Baha'is. Mm-hmm. Okay. They sort of felt perhaps some alienation from their own culture, some interest as foreigners also, they're always out to prove their point. They got to know one guy, that was one group. Some others were just sort of ordinary people, some fairly well off, some not, but all sort of business background. A group who had, I guess, gone to school together, and they used to go, they got me in this routine of, you know, the Friday morning hike, and then tea and so forth, and just going to Tajrish and coming back in the evening. And Mr. Nafisi was a full believer in all that, so he thought that was very healthy, and once he sort of checked these people out, he encouraged that. Then there was another one who was very interesting, who I'm not sure Nafisi was too enthusiastic about, but it was interesting, was one guy I got to know, a very bright guy, and I ran into him sort of by accident much later on. All I knew about him that his father, I guess, had been a mullah when he was Iraqi, and his mother was Iranian, and he absolutely hated the clergy. Mm-hmm. Absolutely hated the clergy. And he had an aunt who lived a long time in...
This was one of your students?
Yeah. And he had an aunt who lived a long time in the States, and actually was got a medical degree at Columbia and everything. And so he said, well, look, why don't you... You know, sometimes on Friday nights, sometimes we'd come over to my aunt's and, so forth. Well, when his aunt was fasting, I don't know if she wasn't married. I don't know if she was divorced or widowed or what. But two things struck me. That first thing I didn't didn't ring a bell at the time, but the aunt's name was Dr. Kiyanuri. Okay. And the second thing is that despite the fact that this kid was always telling me about how awful the mullahs were in destroying Iran, is that there were pictures of mullahs all over the house. Okay, so along with pictures of Iranians at Columbia gathered for Nowruz in 1945 or something, you know, it's very strange. But the aunt was very sophisticated, very Americanized. Then we got a lot of talking. I think I guess she was the sister of Kiyanuri, who is now in jail, and they're what grandchildren of some of the Sheikh Fazlunuri. So that was the mullahs, and she didn't seem to like the mullahs very much either, despite all these pictures. But I remember that was an interesting series of encounters.
Those were probably the family heirlooms.
Yeah,
on the wall.
Yeah. Then Nafisi himself had some people he wanted me to meet. One was a very bright Iranian kid who, I don't know what's happened to him, his father was a general or something, who studied in the States and was home that summer, and we used to do things together. And then he had a friend who had an American wife, and they had a place in Damavand, and we used to go there. So anyway, so I got a very broad spectrum as far as sort of official Americans or governed Americans, or let's go to Iranian attitudes toward Americans. I think Iranians very much in the early 60s, except for the Mossadegh thing that people really didn't talk about. I think people were still fairly naive about America and democracy and friendship toward Iran, generally, I would say.
In other words, you didn't at that point.
No, I didn't feel any no hostility at all. Interest. This was a period too, though. Remember when Iran was still very, America was still quite novel for Iran. This is before television. This is a period where I doubt if there were 300, except for missionaries, AID, and a relatively small embassy and a cultural program. There were very few Americans in Iran at all. Maybe no more than 100 wives, and God knows how many husbands, practically no business Iran Americans. America still wasn't as associated with the Shah as it was later. There was really, in 62, there was no military presence really at all, practically. There was... when I was there, I mean, AID had a very point. Asli Chahar had been converted to AID, which was a very cutback program. So it was a very different thing. No, anti-Americanism wasn't a thing. Under David Nall, the Iran, one of the more interesting things I saw is through really, on the whole, very good leadership. The way the Iran-America Society, not so much from the English side, from the cultural side, was able to introduce things from the outside and also patronize talented people from the inside who wouldn't have had much of a chance in this very inbred Farhang-e Hunar, Alai Palbud system, which was a very, I think, an inbred system. But under David Nall, this was just beginning. And it was just becoming a place where people sort of gather. This was like maybe a year before they moved to Abbasabad. I've always thought myself that in many ways the move to Abbasabad was unfortunate because it was just a lot further from the university, and in a way it sort of changed the economic socio profile of the clientele, so to speak. But then, you know, Americans I met, official or not, one of the family I live with, he was a technical education teacher, did his job and that was about it, didn't really get involved or mix in. David Nall, as I said, around Rex, I thought was awfully effective. And really over the years, you know, since the revolution, has been one of the very few Americans I've known who's really sort of stuck to his Iranian friends from many years before. And there was a couple of AID people I met through Nafisi, but I really didn't know them.
Apart from Tehran, were there any other cities where Iran American Society
At that existing? Time, I really, quite frankly, I really don't remember. I think they had them in Kermanshah.
Yeah,
Shiraz and Isfahan, that far back, but I really don't know. Because, so then, also I want to go back to another image, is that sometimes I think it's helpful in this sort of an oral history or interview or recollections, is sort of one's first impressions. Mm-hmm. And my first impressions of Iran were very, very strange. It happened that my plane arrived in the middle of the night, and as I said, they were living way up in Shamran. This was in Maribad, and this is before all these parkways and stuff. And the next, and a relative of their family had died, so Nafisi had to go to a khatm or something early in the morning. So he had asked. This is sort of complicated too, that Hussein, this friend of mine's mother was dead at this point, and Nafisi had remarried, so he figured too once in a while that he shouldn't take all the burden of me, that Hussein's relatives from his mother should also have the burden too.
What was the burden?
Taking care of me, yeah, right, you know.
Financially too?
No, you know, just,
I see.
You know how this is, tanha naboshe,
right.
Barname doshte boshe, you know.
And sarishkam.
Pare, you know, the routine.
Right.
So, better than not. So, he asked a guy, same from his mother's side, had a relative who was very high up in Darbar, and to go in, so at midnight, we arrived, and some little guy in a funny uniform that I had no idea was arrived on the, it was sort of a dive bar servant, arrived on the plane and asked for me. And I said, I'm in, I know what's going on. And then they wanted my bags, and so, you know, there were about three or four of these little guys in their little uniforms with their things on there. But I didn't know what the hell was going on. And nobody else did either. I mean, even the Iranians on the plane. So, yeah, as I said, I was in the 1890s or so. Off I went with these guys, and sort of on the runway was a jeep.
You didn't pass through the customs?
Oh, no. This is big stuff. And the custom was a jeep, and this relative of my friend's was there in the jeep, and I didn't know any Farsi, and he knew only French, and my French was strictly high school, so that we were all chanté and everything, and there was a station where I had to carry my baggage, which didn't amount to much, so I was a little puzzled, because I didn't know quite who this guy was, and what all this was, and we went off to a hotel, like I said, the first night a hotel he owned, and I guess, you know, he had... It was very Darbari. I had all sorts of flowers, all sorts of fruit, and I didn't know what the hell was going on. And I went to sleep, and maybe an hour later, and this is, I was awakened by noises and foreign noises and foreign smells. And that was sort of my earliest recollection of Iran, you know, the people selling stuff and all the noise and how noise... high noise levels start so much earlier than it does here, even in commuting, and the smells of the bread, and good smells and bad smells, and donkey smells, and all sorts of things. And this is sort of my first recollection of Iran. Mm-hmm. Now, that is... Okay, then Hussein came. Then I left the American family I'd been staying with and moved in with them. We went first to Ramsar for about 2 weeks. Now, one of the big differences between Iran of the early 60s that I saw in Iran even in the late 60s is that sort of in the higher levels, higher social levels, not really economic, but sort of social levels, Iran was really very limited, very restricted compared to what it was even in the late 60s. Now,
limited in what sense?
I'll expand in this. For example, really in the early 60s, except for Babelsar, which was really just starting, Ramsar was sort of the place on the Caspian. Now, there was a hotel and villas. What really shocked me is most of the villas that I saw anyway in the early 60s, by American standards, were really crummy. You know, these are sort of concrete boxes or whatever, but these were villas and so forth. But you know, in the life, everybody sort of knew everybody else. Met a lot of people that summer. I've sort of always known, you know, known ever since. A lot of people who were, you know, younger Iranians who were home from Europe or the States, and some cousins of my friends. Okay, so anyway, it was very nice, and this friend had, Hossein had three younger brothers who were, I mean, much younger than he, who were sort of 7, 8, or 9 or something, very interested in things American. We had a very good time. But, you know, from, as I said, Ramsar was a very strange, in a way, resort then to what I was used to. As I said, everybody knew everybody else. At night they had sort of a, I don't know, a 1950s Italian quartet or something play at the casino, and that was about it. But it was, you know, and they'd have, I think every once in a while they'd have a foreign movie in the hotel ballroom or something. They went movie. It was really very, very, I don't know, how should I say, very remote and very different. Then we started traveling. We went to, usually Hossein and I traveled by ourselves around Iran, mostly by bus, in different places, in places where they didn't have relatives, usually the vocational education people, because that's what his father was into. Also, a little aside, quite frankly, I practically didn't know what vocational education was. Mr. Nafisi was really convinced that this was the role Iran had to take for progress. So another thing I did before Hossein got there, I got tours, you know, compulsory tours of practically every type of vocational training school there was in the Tehran area, which was interesting too. Now, we went to, well, as I say, in places where we, where he didn't have relatives, we'd usually stay or be looked after by technical education people. First place we went to was Rasht. I remember we got a tour of the Shilat and these various, you know, there was several schools where orphans or something did handwork and stuff. And so it was really very interesting. Heavy on social projects and education projects, this first tour of Iran. Then we went back to Tehran, then we went to Isfahan and to Shiraz. In Isfahan we were pretty much on our own and had a very good time. This was, you know, sort of pre-Abbas Shah Abbas Hotel, the Iran Tour Hotel. It was very sort of strange, sort of British colonial thing was the hotel then. And we stayed there. Then we went on to Shiraz, and Shiraz was more interesting because on both sides of Hossein's family, he had relatives who had actually had more than both. He had lots of relatives, although none originally Shirazi, who sort of branches of the family or people had settled on Shiraz, because his father's brother's wife was the daughter of Ghavan, and this same father's brother's daughter was married to Dr. Ghavani, who had just come back from wherever he had studied and was sort of a young guy just sort of having culture shock and getting started in Shiraz. So we visited them, and sort of kept. And he had other relatives. So we had a very good, got to visit a lot of old houses, a lot of old barracks before these were opened up to the public. And that was very nice. And we didn't get to Mashhad on this tour. We came back and that was, the summer was over. It was a very novel and new experience for me.
Was Iran the first foreign country that you had gone
no,
to?
No, I'd been to Europe. I'd traveled in Europe with my parents, and I'd traveled to Mexico, traveled to Canada, also stopped in Europe a bit on the way to this, to Iran. But the other countries might have initially seemed foreign, but Iran was much more different. I decided that I was really quite interested in the Middle East and so forth. So after that, really not much was offered on the Middle East at Georgetown. But the summer after that, the summer of 1963, University of Michigan had a summer program in Persian. So I actually started Persian. No, I started Persian in Georgetown. Sorry, in the summer of 63. And it was funny because at that point, that's when I met a lot of people, a lot of your contemporaries, because this was in the summer of 63 then.
In Washington again?
This was in Washington, mm-hmm. at Georgetown. Had, and this is back when they had these summer workshops. And there was actually a Chinese-American woman who was a linguist who knew about Persian structure, and an Iranian woman who taught us. And the Iranian woman was Mina, the ex-wife of Majid Tehranian. Mm-hmm. So that was the summer I got a heavy dose of
Mina
Jahan, right.
And Jackie, the other one must have
been Jackie. Jackie, yeah. Mm. She was a lousy teacher, but Mina was very good. Yes, mm-hmm. right. And Jackie and Mina and Kayvan Tabari was here that summer working in the Library of Congress, and they gave us all sort of their own version of what was going on in Iran. It was all very interesting. And
you were finishing your undergraduate.
I was just in my second year of undergraduate. Mm-hmm. And then what happened, then also, and this will have to be a holdover to next time, because I think we'll probably, one of the students, one of the few Iranian students at Georgetown, who knew, but I don't think was too cozy with the Majid Tehranian crowd, was a very peculiar, strange guy called Sadat Gutzadeh. Okay. Hussein got to know very well. Because, another thing is that Hussein was also related quite closely to Bazargan, and that I think his mother's mother was a cousin or something of Bazargan or something. And that's a long story. But in any case, so he had this connection. Somehow Gutzadeh knew this. And Hussein told me this much, much later, maybe a year or two ago, which really surprised me, is that, one was never sure where Gutzadeh was coming from, in politically, in sort of the saintly literature of sort of after his death or even after the revolution, his religious side. His piety and his, but quite frankly, I never saw that at all.
And did you get to know him?
Oh yeah, I knew very well. In fact, when I went to Iran in '68, at his, I had an introduction to his brother, and I used to have dinner with his brother and his brother's Swedish wife, etc., etc. All through, and I knew him quite well. I'd say socially anyway, I knew him very well.
What about his other colleagues or friends at that time?
His other colleagues and friends at that time, well, as I said, he said...
Yazdi or Chameron.
No, those, they didn't, this
they
was pre, yeah, they weren't here. And I don't know that early how close he was mm-hmm. with them. Mm-hmm. That might have been a little later. The only guy, Iranian, he used to hang out with is the guy who would be considered very Tagluti, who was totally apolitical. but like the sort of the type of socializing that Sadhak liked. And anyway, so getting back to this, and I'll sort of end on this, it's interesting because I'd always thought that, you know, we knew that Sadhak was anti-Shah. This was the year before I arrived, was the year he threw the teapot at Ardeshir and all this, but, you know, he had, but he was quite a flamboyant figure. I always thought he was probably more to the left than anything else, but Hussein told me that, much to his surprise, that actually that summer when Hussein was going to Iran and I was already in Iran, that Qutbzadeh had approached Hussein and sort of to Hussein's surprise said, well, I assume you'll see Bazargan and all this, and here's some things I want you to take to Bazargan, which Hussein did. Mm-hmm. And never, you know, as
this
I said.
This is 63?
This is 62. 62. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said, Hussein, just in passing, when we were talking one night with some Americans a year or two ago here in Washington, this came up. Mm-hmm. And with that, I think I'll stop.
Okay.
The Oral History Program of the Foundation for Iranian Studies, interview with Dr. Royce, interviewer Hormuz Hikmat, Washington, D.C., June the 6th, 1991.
Okay, I returned to the States from Iran in September of 62, and went back to start my second year at Foreign Service School in Georgetown. At that time, the Foreign Service School and Georgetown had no Farsi. It did have Arabic, which I didn't go into at that point. It had very little really about Middle Eastern studies. This was a period when, as you know, also Mr. Heck, Dr. Heckman, there was very little in the States on these topics. And what there was wasn't really relevant to the present. It was all connected to the past. So, I continued my studies. At that time, when I came back in 62, I moved off campus with this friend of mine, his roommate, who had invited me around this first place. This was in
Mr. Navisi.
Mr. Navisi. And there were, at that time at George, well, all in all, there were very few foreign students, Iranian students, rather, in the States. And in Washington, there were two or three at Howard who were still around, most of them in Washington, doing one thing or another. I didn't know any at American University or at GW. I doubt if there really were any then. Georgetown, there were only three or four. There was, of course, Sadegh Gupzadeh, who we, I guess, talked about in the last time, who was then quite well known amongst the Iranian students in the States. Because the year before, Zahedi, I think by the time by 63, I think definitely Zahedi was no longer ambassador. I think it was Gotsi Nakhai, but I don't remember exactly.
My recollection is that Gotsi Nakhai was the ambassador.
Yeah, I think it is. I Angutz Nachai, I got to, he was some sort of a relative of this friend of mine, Mr. Nafisi, so I, you know, I got to know him. But he was a very unusual, strange character. I never quite figured how he ever made it in the foreign ministry.
What's Nachai you're talking about?
Yeah, he was a very strange guy. He was a very sort of poetic and rather out of it politically type, he always struck me. But anyway, he was, for reasons I didn't understand then and don't understand now, for a couple of years he was in
Did you get a chance to see him?
Oh, yes! Oh, yes.
Through whom?
Through Nafisi.
I see.
He's somehow, well, if you really want to know, Nafisi's, one of Nafisi's paternal uncle's wives, the wife of a paternal uncle of Nafisi, was somehow related to Gutz and Nafei. So, anyway, Chutza had really made a name for himself, as you remember, I think in 61 or so.
Did you get to meet him too?
Oh, I knew Chutza very well. But Chutza, you know, at that party, Noru's party that Ardashir had, and he raised all his wasn. So Chutza amongst the Iranians was quite a personality. Everybody, regardless of their background or so forth, was rather taken by Gutzadeh's courage and sort of daring and charisma. Because quite frankly, I don't think I knew any Iranian student of that period in the States who didn't sort of feel like Gutzadeh. You know, that the Shah must go. But that it was a dictatorial, terrible regime for Iran. Really, I mean, you were there, you know. But very few people, you know, were quite as outspoken as Gulzadeh.
Who else among the Iranian students?
Okay, amongst Iranian students, okay, at that time, at Georgetown, there was this Gulzadeh Nafisi, a woman who really wasn't involved in anything, and a guy called Hussein Goli Samson Bakhtiari, who was sort of a nice guy who had quite a bit of money and was studying languages and was a good sidekick of Gutzadeh. Where I got to know more active, and then there was a guy who came through to study English who was somehow related to Nafisi called Siavashe Dehesh, who now is in Houston, who's somehow in the oil business one way or another. And anyway, and somehow related to Nemazi, you know, the rich Hajman. Anyway, so the next summer, the summer of 1963, they used to have linguistic language workshops around the country. It just happened that summer that the language, Farsi language, Middle East language thing was at Georgetown. And so I decided to take to start Farsi there, and we learned it was strictly spoken Farsi. They didn't even teach us the alphabet, but it was helpful. And the teacher was a woman, a Chinese woman actually, who was a linguist, called Jackie Wei, whom you I'm sure know through all this. And her so-called native informant was a fascinating woman called Mina Jahan, who was the wife of Majid Tehranian, right?
Mina Jahan.
Mina, what did I say?
Ami.
Oh, sorry, Mina. Okay, Mina Jahan. And so we got to know them, and they were renting an apartment in Washington for the summer, and so lots of times we'd go, and they knew, I can't remember if Hussein and Nafisi introduced them to Sadegh or they knew Sadegh. They might not have known Sadegh before that summer. Anyway, so we used to go there a lot. They ran an apartment in Southwest Washington, in those towers, actually near my office, which we knew then. And they had a very interesting friend who got to know, who I got along with very well, and Nafisi got along very well, with called Kevani Tabari. who was here that summer to do research on the Dissertation Library of Congress. And of course, also we got to know at that time the Aipur Hadi, who was, is, and will be forever, you know, in the Library of Congress. And so anyway, we got to know each other, and we got to know through them. I guess Hossein got to know Shahina Fatemi somehow, and he was here. And then one of the people at Howard, who was very involved in all these confederations, that was this guy, Garib, who's this big guy, he's here now, who's a husband of a friend of Mrs. Bahiri.
Right.
He was very active with his brother. He had a brother and a cousin. They were very involved.
Did you feel sympathetic towards their political ideas in terms of,
Of course.
Being critical of the Iranian regime?
Of course, very much so.
Why?
Because...
How much did you know about the Iranian situation?
Well, I knew most of what I... Well, I knew quite a lot from the year I was there.
Right.
The 3 months I was there. And I knew that generally, the students certainly thought the regime was brutal. And as I told you, when I was there in 62, people talked. When I went back in 68, the sort of climate of fear was, it was a totally different thing. But in between, you'd had Punzai Cordon and all sorts of things. I'll be very frank with you, you know. Generally the feeling that it was a dictatorial regime, that it was a cruel regime. People really didn't talk very much. Was it doing much for the advancement of Iran or not? They didn't seem to care much about that. What they really cared about were the human rights issues. And the human rights issues were the basic thing. It certainly made sense to me. And
were you yourself politically
I wasn't active? No, I really wasn't. Quite frankly. And to give you an example how this hit home, the Foreign Service School had a magazine, and I think, if I'm not mistaken, in between sort of late 62, early 63. On the excuse that the majlis elections were rigged, the Shah closed the majlis, right?
61.
Mm-hmm. Was it still open? But anyway, right. That whole issue of the closing, things like that, right. Really upset people. And I remember this Hossein Nafisi wrote an article just in a student publication in Georgetown about the problems of lack of democracy and lack of human rights and so forth in Iran. And to show how the regime worked, he got a letter from his father, who was in Iran, and this is probably in 62 when this happened, before I went to Iran. He got a letter from his father that the Savak had visited his father, who was a government employee, etc., and really sort of, told him, if your son doesn't shut up, he's going to be trouble, and you're going to be trouble. That's what happened. Somehow, this article that Hossein wrote had got to Radio Baku, and Radio Baku had broadcast this, that the son of so-and-so had written this article, and so forth. It was just a little some publication.
Somehow it strikes me that all the Iranians that you knew at the time were politically active and conscious and were critical. Did you know anyone who were not political?
Never met one.
How come?
I don't think they existed. They didn't exist around here.
Not in Washington?
No.
That they were either neutral towards the regime or were not that political?
I met none that were neutral toward the regime. Really? Mm-hmm. Quite frankly, I really didn't.
Not supportive, obviously. Then
nobody's supportive, and like Hossein's a very critical guy. He had he knew Shahnaz very well when they were in the embassy, when before I got there, obviously he was a year ahead of me. Ahmed George Diner, he used to go and have dinner Sunday night, you know, with Zahidi and Shahnaz and so forth, but because he knew him. But he certainly was critical of the regime. I think that Iran at that point, I of the Iranians I met, you know, everybody was critical. Though some would take the ones who just came from Iran, like this Dehesh, or another guy who was somehow connected to Hossein, whose name I forgot, were. You know, at first a little reluctant.
Kevan Tabari wasn't critical of the regime at that time.
He was terribly critical of the regime at that time. With us he was.
That's not my recollection.
With us he was.
He was not.
Privately he was. Maybe not in publicly, maybe not in New York. Mm-hmm. But when he was in Washington doing research with Tehran and Mina and these various Fatimis flowing around, and he was. And
did you attend any of the meetings of the
The only thing I attended was there was a and then of course then through them I met I think the most interesting of the bunch, even more interesting than Kofzadeh Abrahamian, who I find always a rather fascinating character. And somehow Abrahamian floated in that somewhere. You know, floats. You know, he's sort of like an old, you know, if you really watch these sort of movies from the 30s about the anarchist or the Marxist organizer who sort of floats through, you know, doesn't have a suitcase, maybe has a razor and a toothbrush, sleeps on the floor in the corner. That's my...
In the mold of the leftists.
I think he first floated into my life that summer.
This is in 1963.
Yeah, and he's been floating in and out ever since. I really do like him very much, you know, personally. But, the only thing I attended, and I don't know if you were you there then? Were you in New York that summer? Okay. They had this bizarre idea that they were going to get buses from Washington, Philadelphia, New York, and all meet at Atlantic City. And they had this, on the beach in Atlantic City, they had this sort of picnic and demonstrations and so forth. Do you remember that?
I think I was there.
Yeah. Okay, so, I don't know, they sort of, Hossein sort of convinced me this would really be,
Were you accepted by these activists as a sympathetic American?
Oh, yeah, 100%.
No suspicion?
I don't think so. Mm-hmm. I don't think so. No. And it's very strange, because while lots of Iranians are very suspicious, of the Iranians I've met from that period in Iran, I don't think anybody's very suspicious of me at all. But anyway, people like Yervan or Kevan or Majid or Mina. But anyway, so I went along and also in the same class, in the same language class, this was the first exposure to Persian Iranians of James Bill. And James Bill came along on the bus too, I think. Maybe he didn't. But anyway, it was terribly disorganized. It was absolute chaos, and the three or four buses come from me from different places, couldn't find each other. Remember, then they wanted to start fires and do kebab on the beach, and then the police came and said they couldn't, and it was sort of very chaotic, but it was my first big exposure in the States to this sort of thing. I never really attended. Okay, then somehow that summer or the next summer, sort of Hossein's style was sort of cramped because Derek Sheshin kicked his father out of the Ministry of Education, and his father was made, guardian of Iranian students or whatever, Sarparast, here. So Hossein's father arrived here. Hossein. Stayed with, you know, in an apartment, but his father was here in that house somewhere out in Maryland, I don't remember where. And Kwesi's father was to supervise and watch out for all these crazy running students.
During this time you were continuing your
education? Oh yeah, sure, for a long time, until 61 to 65. So I remember Hossein, we had an apartment, Hossein, and the building still exists in sort of the outskirts of Georgetown, the corner of 35th and R Street. And Hossein, that summer later, used to try to organize sort of gatherings with people like Gopsadeh and his father and so forth. But his father had a number of sort of goon types that he had brought with him
from
Iran. And one guy, you must know this guy. And later he became very important, I heard. Ebi. Anyway, the name will come back. Oh, and there's a guy who's here.
What was the function?
They were students who came on scholarships, but they somehow, I guess, were supposed to, you know, they were more sympathetic with the regime. Mm-hmm. And there's a guy you must know, Nader knows. He's got a PhD in education. He's a assistant superintendent or something in the district schools.
Now, here?
Yeah. Who's originally Iranian. He was one of those guys. Anyway, so those were very interesting meetings, and Hossein and so forth, and Gopzadeh. And, you know, at least socially, Kayvon was with Majid and Mina all the time. And Kayvon went to that picnic in New York on the beach. Mm-hmm. So I always thought, you know, Kayvon was part of that group. But I only learned later, I guess, from Newsom that he wasn't, you know, so involved with them as I thought. So that's about it. And those were really the only Iranians at Georgetown. Then, maybe the next summer, this same thing was at Michigan. And I went, that's the summer of 64. And I went to Ann Arbor for, and in Ann Arbor, I learned, you know, the beginnings of reading and writing Farsi, as well as, learning more about spoken Farsi. And one person I met there, that's where I met, I guess the first time I met, Marhume Oy Elohi, who was a student there. And I think really the only Iranian, a woman who was a graduate student there, was the assistant to Alan Luther, who taught us. But I think the only Iranian I met at Michigan that summer was Oy Elohi. And
Sirusela.
Yeah. And so that's about it. Then
did you after graduation, yeah, which was 1965.
Then I got a scholarship to go to Princeton for advanced studies, a very good grant. And I was at Princeton 3 years, and I studied Arabic as well as Farsi, and a lot of Middle Eastern history, sociology in the Middle East, and so forth. At that time, there were practically no Iranians at Princeton at all. Mm. When I came back from Iran later, in the 70s, there were, but in 68, there were practically no Iranians. And the only Iranian I remember was a guy who was in comparative literature, graduate student in comparative literature, who was our TA in Farsi, called Arbabi Isfahani, is his family name, Said Arbabi Isfahani. Mm-hmm. Arbab Isfahani, not Arbabi, Arbab Isfahani. And he later went back to Jundi Shapur University, mm-hmm, and became, I don't know, some, you know, vice chancellor or something at Jundi Shapur, whose room was English language and literature. Did you ever run into him?
No.
He wasn't very, he wasn't at all activist, but he was, you know, he was anti-regime. Mm-hmm. You know, that was a period too when none of these people were the least bit Islamic. Lutzadeh apparently had, I later learned from Hussein, had always had good connections with Bazargan. But he certainly didn't, maybe it wasn't politically wise to come out that way, because certainly nobody else was particularly Islamic. The people I knew. And there were these Berkeley people and Texas people I learned about later, but I had no exposure to them at all. About Iranians and Palestinians, then one of the more interesting experiences I had, about maybe 67? What was it? No, it was after I came back from Iran. No, sorry. So anyway, that was about my, and then in Princeton, I said there were really very few Iranians.
You said
there were some, I take back, there were two graduate students at Princeton in the graduate college when I was there. One was a guy who was really also rather unpleasant and never smiled and so forth, and was turned out Islami, called Ali Sabzavari, who got a PhD in some sort of engineering and ended up in Shiraz. He's Esfahani, but he ended up in Pahlavi University.
Mm-hmm.
Very unpleasant, sort of grumpy type. And I knew him when I went to Shiraz. And Bahram told me that he went 100% with the Islamists.
Isn't he the same fellow who represents Iranian intersection here in Washington?
That's Sabzalion. This is Sabzavari. Mm-hmm. Sabzavari. Isvani, man. One case, Mr. Sabzavari. Then there was a marvelous guy. Again, these guys were engineer types. They weren't very political at all. Called Arsalane Garamani, who's Shirazi. Mm-hmm. And he's still at Shiraz University. Friend of Bahram.
So
that's about it. Then, one of the more interesting things, about 68, and somebody I really kept contact with and I found very helpful and informative, was Ibrahimia. And I used to go in to, must have been 60, before he got married, must have been 66. When was Bahmane Ghashqai
executed, you mean?
When did he have, when was his revolt going on? Was that about 66?
I'm not sure.
Okay, well, when his revolt was going on, somehow, and I can't remember exactly where I met Ibrahimian, it was through Mina and so forth, but somehow, somebody I always kept up contact with that group was Ibrahimian. And I used to go in sometimes to do things. If there were programs at Columbia, I'd go in. I remember the year, must have been 66 or something, that Hafez Farmayan was there, and he had some really ridiculous lectures trying to defend the Shah that I came in from Princeton.
I think this was at Columbia.
Columbia, yeah. Were you there or not?
60.
This must have been 66 or so.
66.
It was before Yervan got married, which must have been by 66. So then he used to have a really cruddy apartment with Farhad Khamsi. And I used to go in there sometime from New York, from Princeton, and sometimes spend, if I was doing something in New York, I could just sleep on the floor. It was very sort of fly. And I also met through them this Reza Sheikh al-Islami. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, now I know how I got to know these people better. In the summer of 65, or summer of 66, took a course in the summer in Russian at Columbia. And I knew Yervan, I guess I met Sheikh al-Islami. Then. I never couldn't figure him out then, I can't figure him out now. But I liked Yervan very much, and Khamsi I liked. He was very gentle and very nice. And Then when I come in, then I had some exposure. The reason I asked you about Bahmani Rashvari is it was a really cruddy, and I don't know what group this was politically, because it really weren't, it wasn't today, and none of these other groups existed then, the Mahanism Confederation. But there was really a cruddy loft somewhere near Port Authority bus terminal.
Mm-hmm.
This was really before armed struggle was much and before anything had been defined. But I went a couple times there on Friday, and they had Friday nights. They had things on Friday nights. And I used to go with Yerevan there. Again, I was the only Choreji. And except for a very, and I think I've still got it, there was a really strange character who apparently used to float around in all these leftist things in New York. This wasn't anti-regime, this was very leftist. And sort of a hippie type with a knapsack where he had the works of Chairman Mao in about 20 languages, and he would know which groups were meeting.
Do you remember his name?
No, I just remember this guy appearing. And I remember I bought, he goofed, he didn't have Chairman Mao in Farsi, but he had in Arabic, but just for fun I bought it, and I think I still have it. But anyway, so I used to go several times, and they were always having things about Bahmani Rashkai. Mm. Do you know that? Do you know what I'm talking about?
No, that episode I don't.
Oh. Mm. And Farhad Khamsi was there too. But nobody else I can remember. I mean, Sheikh al Islami definitely was not there.
Mm.
And I can't remember at this point anybody else. Mm. So that was essentially my exposure to Iranians in the States in the period between the fall of 62 and the fall of 68, when I returned to Iran.
Between 68?
The fall of 62 and September 68, when I returned to Iran, when I went back to Iran to do research.
What was the reason you returned to Iran?
Okay, I returned to Iran because I had a Fulbright grant to do research on a topic it took me years and years to narrow down. But at that point, I was interested in learning about Sufi brotherhoods in Iran in the 19th and maybe early 20th century, something nobody really knew much about, and so forth and so on. And on my way to Iran,
and a Fulbright scholarship?
Yeah, Fulbright scholarship. I stopped in Switzerland, and Hossein had known very well and had written me a letter of introduction to Mr. Jamalzadeh, whom I went to visit, and he in turn wrote me some letters of introduction to people. It was really a great help. And I arrived, in Iran, and I remember it was very funny. It's just a hotel called the Hotel Sina, which was on Takhta Jamshid. The reason I remember this is there had just been the earthquake, I think, in Khorasan.
Mm-hmm.
That summer before that, and there was some big fundraiser too. So it was very shalom in the bog, and we couldn't sleep because all these people were there, eating dinner at midnight was just sort of new to us, and staying up to 4 in the morning and then get up at 7 in the morning and go to work, which is something I still can't understand how the Iranians do it. Right? But and they really do it. Mm-hmm. Nothing. But anyway, so I had this grant, and I could use Tehran University libraries and stuff, and I had introduction to...
And you resided in Tehran?
Yeah, I resided in Tehran for 2 years. and
basically
research, mostly research. I got to know some professors and sent him some course to Tehran University. I had one professor, a guy called Saadet-e Gulhari, who was a Rumi specialist but knew a lot about what I was interested in, who was very helpful to me. And maybe one of the things I'll talk about is Dr. Gulhari, because this was totally new to me. I had from my professor in Princeton letter of introduction, and really I worked with him more than I worked with anybody, but I remember, you know, when I got to Tehran, I called him and I went to visit him, and, you know, I had, I don't listen to, you know, how on the record or off the record, but anyway, so I might as well.
Yes.
I don't know how much I should say. But anyway, so anyway, I got to know this guy, and he was very interesting, and through him I met a lot of older people who were interested in literature, sort of Dr. Yegane types.
Mm-hmm.
He was a friend of Dr. Yegane, that sort of type. Type who, you know, is equally comfortable in his salon, equally comfortable on the floor. You know, cross Dr. Yegane out of your day, by the way. but sort of that type.
Mm-hmm.
So I got to know through him a lot of people of this type, and a lot of people who were sort of survivors of the constitutional period who helped me in my research, and that was very interesting.
And you had registered in the university?
I hadn't registered, no, but I had you know, research facility. But one of the persons, I used to go to the university and to the Bashkar, and I knew the other foreign students in Tehran and so forth. But probably, you know, to cut things short and through, hi, salam alaikum, how's your name? I mean, really, there's so much I have to limit, but Dr. Gulhareen and his friends were very helpful. I learned a lot about traditional Iranian culture. I got to know people like Nur Ali Khan Burman, and anyway, let's talk about three types of Iranians I met, or four types, I guess. One, through Dr. Gulhareen, mostly people involved who were interested in Sufism, people who were very interested in things like Persian music, like Nur Ali Khan Burmand and Bahari and Hussein Tehrani, and you know, through Dr. Gulhareen, got to sit in on a lot of their parties, which were a lot of very interesting for me, but very different from anything I'd been used to. That's one thing. Second, which was in the long run, for Iranian politics, one of the most interesting things for me. And all these guys who used to come to Gulhareen, some were ex-ministers, ex-governors, ex-this and that. Nobody was particularly pro-Shah. I think a lot of them had been two-day or...
did they really express their views about the regime?
They would, because they had...
It was limited.
No, because they... had particular social habits.
I see.
Mm-hmm. And they used to get very relaxed
and talk a lot.
Yeah, and become brave, exactly. So anyway, that's one thing. Probably in many ways politically, for political insights into Iran, the most interesting thing, because I'd met a different kind of person. Because through Nafisi or even Gulhareen or other people, I'd meet people who were educated, who had a lot of family background, whatever that means, but they thought they did, and, you know, from moderate to at least adequate money. But at that time, the Iran-American Society in Tehran had I think they closed it in the mid or late 70s, which was a big mistake. They had a student center near the university. And this student center near the university was very, very interesting, because unlike Abbasabad, where they got Bachar J.T.O. and Tito, they got at this one near the university, mostly sort of middle class or lower middle class kids from the provinces who had come to Tehran University.
Just to learn English?
No.
Like the other one?
This had everything. It had movies. Mm-hmm. It was a real sort of student center, regardless of, run by a very interesting woman called Khalil Ziyai. And it was very interesting. And one of the things, they didn't have English classes at all. But what they had were, they had mostly...
What was it called?
I don't remember, Merkez-i Donishjuan or something like that. Merkez-i Donishjuan. It was on Shah Reza, across the university.
But connected with the Iran-American
Society? Yeah. It was very different. And they had like ping pong, and a chess club, and a library.
Like a youth club.
Yeah, like a youth club.
Run by Americans.
Run by an Iranian woman. But it was part of Anjuman Iranian Rekhoz. And anyway, they wanted volunteers from the Fulbright grantees to come there in the evenings and do English conversations.
Informally.
And I got to know a totally different type of person there that I probably wouldn't have met. And out of that bunch, and almost all the people I met there ended up one way or another on the winning side in the revolution. And it's a very, very strange story. I remember...
You kept remembering their names.
Oh, I always remember names. And they always remember me. And so we keep running in. Like I had an experience just yesterday. Where a guy and somebody who is very involved in a Marxist Islamic bad nom amongst most of our friends group based in Baghdad at the moment arrived in town invited by some congresspeople. Somebody from that group came to see me and said,
recently?
Very recently. So and so would really like to see you. I said, he said, he was in your English class at Tehran University in 1969. Okay?
So you did conduct English classes in that?
They're not classes, they're these conversation groups. Just conversation groups. Who are you? What do you do today? Did you read anything interesting? You know, very informal. So he was, and lots of other people.
And you remember his name from that?
Of course I do, yeah. Now, again on this English thing, one of the most interesting things that happened, and it was sort of, this Mohandas, you know, always in and out, this Mohandas Nafisi character always appears in all this. It's very funny because Nader was saying, you're going, you're in these interviews with Hormuz. I bet all you do is tell him about Mohandas Nafisi. He said, why is he telling you? He said, no, of course not, but, I know how you work. I said, yeah, you're anyway. So, Mohandas, one of my things was that, Mohandas Nafisi was almost neo-Nazi, and everything had to be planned, Akdum 1, 2, 3. So he had all his plans for me while I was in Iran, but I had my own plans for myself. But every once in a while, I let his plans encroach upon me. And he really was interesting because it's the last thing one would expect. He said to me that this must have been in 69 or 70. He said to me, you really... you're learning a lot about Iran, doing the Sufi stuff, from these people, us, of course, our relatives, our friends, but you've really got to know something about the mullahs. Okay? Mm-hmm. And he said, look, you studied some Arabic in Princeton, but for your research and so forth, you need better Arabic. And I've got a friend who knows somebody who needs English. Have I ever told you this before?
Okay. No, you haven't.
Okay. So, I want to get you together. So, now he was no longer Modi. He wasn't in the Ministry of Education, but he was in some shura at the Ministry of Education. So, well, look, I want you to meet my friend because he wants to look you over and so forth. And we're together on this shura, and we're in the come at 7 o'clock. I mean, the winter was very cold, very dark. To the old Ministry of Education, given Ekpata. And so I went there. And they had these little houses in the garden that had been originally for the various wives of Zilla Sultan, who had built that place. But the various commissions met in these little houses. So I went to this little house and was a little curious about Mohandas Nafisi's friend. And they came out and waited in the waiting room. And they came out of the commission. And, you know, of the seven or eight, there may be a couple women, a number of men, you know, looking very sort of now, they'd say, Tavuti, like Mohandas Nafisi. And then a rather roly-poly mullah with a black turban. And he introduced me to this roly-poly mullah, was Rezoi Borgei, who is somehow, who's an uncle of Borgei here.
Mm-hmm.
And he's now, he's been since the beginning of the revolution, the Islamic Republic representative in Dobay. But anyway, so he said, well, I have a friend who wants to learn English, and he'll work with you. He's studying English, but he can't speak it. And you studied Arabic, but you know you don't know that much Arabic, so it's good you and this friend of mine get together. So he and I were working in the Ministry of Education, Rubiroi Dasar Ali, near the American Embassy. In this Talimati Dini office, and we're rewriting the Talimati Dini book. So you come on, let's say, every Thursday afternoon, or Thursday would be for the main Wednesday afternoon, and maybe one other day, and you do a little English pronunciation with him, and he'll help you with your Arabic. So I had some Arabic text I couldn't understand. So I went and met this fascinating character called Bahonar, who was then a rather young mullah sofer. And we got to know each other very well. And we used to go on Friday, we used to walk to Pascale and meet his friends, and we used to go and so forth. Now, very interesting was that he never talked
politics
up to that point, at that point in politics. Now then, I got to know...
Did Bahonar, was he interested in learning English too?
Oh, very much. And he learned very good English with me. So anyway, but anyway...
On a regular basis?
Regular basis, like 2 days a week exchange, 1 hour English, 1 hour Arabic. Now, but this is where your family tips in. For my Sufi stuff, I was trying to interpret the symbols in some paintings, and a friend of mine, this is a whole new series of friends, maybe in another, who introduced me to Pallavan, this is another type of person, and still spends a lot of time with Pallavan, called Jawad Sayyar, whom you don't know, I don't think. But anyway, I asked Sayyar, who worked for Fahagahunar, if he could find me somebody who could help me with these symbols. And he introduced me to a really weird guy called Ali Askai Vali, who was sort of a Darvish type, who was a portrait painter. And I got to know Vali, and he's very interesting. And Vali's best friend, I mean, they were together. So now we're in Bahonar. I'd said that I've been through Borgay and Bahonar, I'd gone to their office, which was in a very modern building across from Donatora Ali, just below the American Embassy in Roosevelt. And got to know each other, but we never talked politics up to that point. Then Mohana comes on the scene. And sometimes on Friday
night... This is still 1968?
Maybe 69 now. Probably we're into 69. I don't remember. Maybe 69. Mohana and Vali used to go there with some sandwich shop on the old Chevron Road. It was really rather a cruddy place. But I think Mohana either owned it or owned the building. He owned lots of buildings all over Tehran. Right?
Right.
And so, for some reason, their idea, rather than going someplace nice, was to go to this cruddy sandwich shop. There was usually nobody else in there. We'd, sometimes on Sunday nights, we had nothing to do. Vali and Mohana would go there every Sunday night and park that historic car in front and so forth. Anyway, so one night he said, well, look, I do anything next Thursday night. Mohana said, and I said, no. He said, well, I want to take you to a place that's, you know, be very instructive to you. You'll learn new things about Iran and so forth and so on. So it was all very strange. So I said, sure. So they picked me up in this Mohanaobile, this strange car, as I said, 1930 maybe Packard, which was like, you know, everything was polished and it was like brand new and nobody dared touch this car. And so we drove off to Old Shamron Road, a little above the sandwich shop, to Hosseini Ershad. So, because somehow Mohana was a big wig in Hosseini Ershad. I don't know if he had contributed to it or what, but he had real party there. And when you go in there with him, you know, they'd all... I remember the night we were there, the late Mardar Motahari, who I'd seen around Tehran University, was there. And he was very, we talked to Motahari and so forth. Shariati wasn't there. Talked to Motahari, and I was introduced to Motahari, and we went and sat more or less by Motahari. There I was, the Farangi, and with old Oy Mohana, with old Oy Wali.
You were introduced to them as an American...
just Oy Royce, yeah, not even that, Oy Royce, introduced them all. So we sit there. You know, I'm going to say, no, they have a special speaker tonight. This part was terribly political about it. They were big in all this crap about Islam and science and, you know, so forth, and their speaker. And so the speaker comes in, and who is the speaker but Oy Mohana? And he sees me with Motahari and so forth. I think I was sitting next to Motahari, you know. And, almost fainted. But he went ahead with his thing. Okay, now, it wasn't political law. But, you know, how these things are. If you go with somebody and then you sit next to Motahari and Hosseini Ershad, then people who wouldn't have talked to you, you know, totally innocently, not even really knowing what Hosseini Ershad was, then once you do that, people who wouldn't talk to you before talk to you. Mm-hmm. Okay, so, now
let me bring this up.
Yeah.
Although they were not speaking in their lectures or in their conversations with you about politics.
No.
Did you have any feelings at all that what their attitude was vis-a-vis the regime? Did you sense anything?
Not until after that night.
Mm-hmm.
They were very smooth. After that night, everything came out. That night
what
sort of then? Was my initiation by fire. Well, at the same time, Ganji, our buddy Ganji, was head of the law faculty. And Parviz was something other. Was he a dean or?
What year was this?
This is 69 or 70. Parviz was something like, anyway, Parviz was trying to upgrade the English language, English writing skills, and talked to somebody at the American Embassy, and she suggested...
For the record, you're talking about Parvisani.
Yeah, Parvisani. And so suggested that I might be interested, because I had a grant, but I needed more money. So two or three times a week, I would give an English composition class at the law faculty.
In Tehran University?
Yeah. And when I came back, you know, the week after Hosseini Ershad, I realized that a lot of my students had been at Hosseini Ershad. They were very perplexed that, you know, I had been there. I was sitting next to Motahari with these two, you know, rather quaint-looking Focalese with 1930 clothes and little beards. And Vali was sort of the same style as Mr. Mohana. And so then these people would start talking to me. Then Bahunar started talking to me.
Privately?
Yeah. And also, but at that point, Borghei was, the impression I always got, that Borghei was more at this point the brains behind this whole bunch. And they really weren't talking then, and this is very early. They didn't talk about Khomeini. What they talked about is that the Shah's regime was so secular that a lot of things they wanted to do, they weren't allowed to do. And they had this funny idea that Americans could somehow bring pressure on the Shah to get him to do what they wanted to do.
This is the view expressed by people like Bahunar
and Borghei. And what they wanted to do, at that point, was to set up a secular university, an Islamic university, segregated male and female, with sort of a real university, a private university. And they had a lot of money. They could have done this. But they had to get a permit. And the Islamic, Shah's regime, Shah's government, would not permit them to do this. And I think it was a big mistake. And I've always had this sense that when they couldn't do this, it was one of the things that got them more and more radical. I think if the previous regime had gone a little more with these people in legitimate things they were trying to do rather than prevent them from doing it, they might not have alienated them so much. The feeling I got, despite Punzai Khordad and all this, is this people weren't that alienated from the regime. But they couldn't understand quite why the Shah's regime wouldn't let them do anything the way they wanted to do it. Now, one of the ways they tried to...
What was it? What other things they wanted to do?
This is the big... The only thing I remember is this Islamic University was a big, big thing.
In Tehran?
Yeah. And they had the money. And for all I know, old Mohana was one of their supporters. They were somehow very involved with these people. Very. Mm-hmm. I told them, I didn't know anything. That was one story. So, Jim Bill had kept telling me that, you know, he hadn't got to know any mullahs and he wanted to know mullahs. Well, this Oy Borghei, Mahonar didn't have any money and had a rather, cruddy apartment and so forth. But anyway.
Did you go to Mahonar's apartment?
Sure. And I even went to Kerman on a trip and stayed with his cousin, who Iran Manesh, who was a mullah, who was in Dabir, in the Dabir Agency in Kerman, and stayed in his house and so forth. So, but anyway, I knew these people very well. They were nice people. But, so anyway, so I arranged one Friday for Jim and his wife, that time he only had, he must have had two, no, he only had his son, Timmy. And we went up, this guy, a Borgay, had a bog in Shamron near Alap. And so we went there, and the old Borgay went and talked to Jim Bell, because even then, everybody thought Jim Bell had the ear of everybody and so on. And, you know, Jim Bell thought they talked
about... But this was not the impression that they had of you.
No, I'm different. And so, I was different anyway. So then, what happened? I think Jim thought they'd talk about Khomeini and about Pazakhuda. All they wanted to talk about is why can't we have our Islamic university? Yeah.
And that was their only ground at that time.
Right,
no discussion about the Western values or women's freedoms or...
No discussion, except they were very proud that they kept trying to explain to Jim. I remember that this house that Borgay had was a Avdaruni Biruni house. So they sent Ann Bill and the baby boy into the women's side. But I remember he saying to Ann and Jim that, you know, while our lifestyle is different, you know, my wife and my daughters and all these, you know, have gone to university, are educated, and so forth and so on. Okay? So, that's the Islamic phase.
You kept your contact with these people?
I kept my contacts when I come back to Tehran through Mr. Vali, this funny guy.
No, from 68 until...
To 72 when I left Iran. Then I lost contact with them until November 1979. And if you remember, in November 1979, they took the hostages. I was in Arizona teaching the University of Arizona, and Jim Bill called me, and he said that, you know, he was trying to do something to come to Washington, talk to people, try to do something about the hostage thing, and I'm trying to get to Iran, and go with him or work with him and so forth and so on. And I said, well, I think this is an awful thing, and if I can do anything, I'd be glad to help. And then he said, well, what I want you to do is to, he was already in contact with our buddy Mansour Farhang, who was then in the Iran, Jamhuriyat Islamiyah to Washington. And said, do you mind if I ask Mansour Farhang to contact Bahonar and to see if you're coming with me, they get us visas and so forth to go? And so I said, okay, yes, I don't mind. So I came to work, because I knew several of the guys who were hostages. So I came to Washington from Arizona with a suitcase, and we went to the embassy, and sure enough, we got our visas right away. And but then things got all messed up because Mansour Farhang got Ramsey Clark and Andrew Young and all these people involved. So in the end, and then Carter didn't want us. We sort of worked with the State Department on this, but through Henry Precht, who was the desk officer. But then apparently Carter didn't want us to go, so we didn't go, and I don't know, that didn't happen. But that was my last contact indirectly with Bahonar, and then of course he got blown up.
Going back to 1968-69, while you were teaching a course in Tehran University, what else did you do at that time?
I did my research.
Your research?
I'm taking some courses at Tehran University. I did that for 2 years.
And then you were staying in Tehran
for 2 years.
Yeah, 2 years.
Okay,
1970.
In the 70s, I more or less finished my research, but I wasn't satisfied that I knew enough about Iran and Farsi. And my grant ran out, and this job of executive director of your American Sign in Shiraz opened up, so I took that for 2 years, and I did that and continued in some writing up in my research and for my thesis, but so I lived 2 years in Shiraz. But getting back to Tehran University, another place, at Tehran University in the law faculty, I ran into a whole bunch of people who had been in my conversation sessions in the Iran Merit Society. And a lot of these I'm still in contact with. They keep coming into my life.
Mm-hmm.
One was a diplomat with the Islamic Republic and the foreign ministry, and he no longer is. He quit. He had a foreign assignment, and he just called me a couple days ago. Several of the guys, they were all very anti-regime, by the way. National Front types. They were very moderate, but anti-regime. They didn't like the regime. They really didn't quite know what they wanted, so they called themselves National Front. That was sort of enough. But three or four of these guys were young, relatively, when the revolution came in. They probably were early 30s, and were involved with Lahiji and all this human rights law, and, you know, etc. And two or three of them, one guy is still a lawyer in Iran, and most of the rest of them are outside. It's very funny, but I'm still in contact with the guys. Well, they're all, you know, not often, but when they need me or I need them, we're in touch. Then another group of people I met, very strange guy who, in the Fulbright, I met, had these receptions and so forth when we first got there. There was a very interesting guy, about my age, maybe a little older, who had been at the University of Chicago, who taught archaeology at the University of Tehran, who had been back a year or two, called Reza Mostofi. Did you ever run into him?
No.
He's still now, and they sort of stuck with the Islamics, but he told me that he had a friend he thought I'd be interested in to meet him. I met his friend. This friend was a guy who wasn't terribly educated or anything, never been abroad, but he worked in the Ministry of Farhang of Hunan. And it was through him that I met, what's his name? Genghis Pahlavan. And then this guy, about 69, set up a very interesting sort of bi-monthly sort of intellectual discussion group, the Dore for Sham, where we used to meet in the Bashai Bank in Mali, which is something that bothers them.
Mm-hmm.
And Ashraf was there, and Majid Tehranian, Kayvan was there until he went back, in that group, Tamami, who you know, right, mm-hmm. from New York, Tamami was in that. In fact, I think one of the interesting things, I think, was Tamami at your wedding, or was it Bijan or Bahman, or there was some Hikmat wedding that this Tamami went to in Tehran.
It that wasn't mine.
It wasn't yours. Okay, it was one of the others.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe Bijan?
Bijan Hikmat?
Yeah,
no, he wasn't in Tehran.
This was some Tehran. Anyway, so he was in there, Changiz was in this group, it was a very interesting group, and they were all very, all working for the government, but all with anti-government backgrounds. Now Hossein Nafisi was there, a few other people. So anyway, this is a sort of, you know, I don't know if you've learned anything, if any of this is interesting, but
of course,
at least it's a variety.
Mm-hmm.
One, I was lucky that I always try, in knowing people, to get you know, a wide range of...
I was just saying, in your experience as the director of the
Young American Society of Shiraz,
Could you tell us something about what you did in there?
Do you want to do that another night?
Sure.
That's a long, long story.
All right.
That's a whole different thing.
All right.
I'll tell you one more Mullah story.
All right, sure, okay. Go ahead.
When I did this study group, or not in the conversation group, my one student called Hussein Ali Baharluluma Tabatabai, and he was from Borja. And he said, and I really worked with him on his English, even sort of used to have my room. He was a very bright guy and so forth. He's still new. And he was from Borja. And I had this man, I really didn't have much money and so forth, and Tehran was very hot in the summer. And he said, well, Borja is cool, and he went to Borja all summer. Why don't you come for 4 or 5 days to Borja? The bus doesn't, you can take the bus, and it doesn't cost much, except if you leave at 6 in the morning, you can be in Borja by 5 in the afternoon. And, so he gave me this note, go to the Nunvai at the, you know, Charaichi and give him this note and he'll take you to us. So I got to Borja and went to the Nunvai, gave the Nunvai guy a note. He gave us a very funny look. He said, are you sure this is where you want to go? And I said, yeah. And So I went. He took me and went to this very old house with a door knocker and a big, huge old house, and these big old houses in Shiraz, bang, bang. And, some old male servant came to the door and he knew who I was and said that so and so wasn't there, so they just took me into a room with no furniture and got me, and nobody came and nobody was there and so forth. And so the Ema turned out that this guy, I didn't know this, that this guy's father was a big mullah in Borja. And he was also like a cousin of Alay Borujerdi and Alay Hakim and all this. And in the rooms were all the only photographs were all these mullahs all over. So I remember I had bought, because I one thing I could never get used to is aftabe, so I had two suitcases, and one suitcase had maybe 3 rolls of toilet paper in it. And I'll tell you why this is, came up, and I brought presents and stuff, and for his mother and so forth, I brought his sisters, I brought, you know, Pond's hand cream and so forth. It was the usual stuff. And so, anyway, I learned that he was a mullah, my father was a mullah, which I didn't know. And they had a, you know, 2 courtyard, the men and women were separated, so didn't see any women. And they had it was a huge house, and they had a huge courtyard with a pool, with one of these big platforms in the pool, and we, the men, would all sleep, except for the father who'd go in with the women. We, brothers and cousins and stuff, we'd all sleep on this platform in the middle of the pool. And I remember that the first morning, must have been very early, I heard all this hee-hee-hee, and I didn't open my eyes, but you know, the mothers and the sisters and all these had all come to look at the strange foreigner. And then they all disappeared, and I got up and acted as if I hadn't known what was going on. And the day I was leaving Borja, they all the women came to say goodbye, and they said, aha, we've seen you, you haven't seen us. And I said, aha, that's what you think, but it's not true. But again, on political things, like, and a lot of these people who've been my students, who then became very political, I didn't know. For example, in Borja, not a student, but a friend of this Baralulum, Tabatabai, a friend of mine, was a guy called Hadi Ghat. He was a very good violinist. He used to go to bogs and so forth and play violin and so forth. And Alayla, this guy had been very involved in Fedor and Michal and was executed by the mullahs. Then another guy, one of my students from 62 was a guy called, very ironically, was a guy called Abbas Ibn Khordar, who was from Yaz, whose father is some multimillionaire, who's one of these characters who went to this New York feast.
Ajib Ibn Khordar.
Yeah. But Abbas was also Fedayi, and he was executed in revolution. I never figured out how father and son have been executed. They really want money, these creeps. Everything Moftah Shami and Ahmad Khomeini says about these guys, in my opinion, and I hope this is, you know, these Lajavadi type, all they want to make is a buck. You know, and I'm very cynical about all this. I think actually the mullahs are probably right on the mark. I don't know how I got on that stuff, but anyway, I just want to tell you about two more people I thought of who later turned out to be political. I don't know how political they were at that time.
Okay.
On the Khomeini people in the Islamic Republic, the story from my Tehran days, somebody I met who helped me on my Sufi research, who I met through Vali and Mohana, was a guy called Ali Kamali Sabzavari, who was a mullah who was also sort of a Sufi and used to go around to all these groups and preach and do zikr and stuff. You ever heard of him, Kamali Sabzavari? Anyway, very well known guy in certain circles. One birthday of the 12th Imam, he invited me to go with him on his rounds and all the various places he went. That was very interesting. But the point I want to make is that this must have been October of 69. I met him near Baharistan. And at that point, sort of near South Mumbai, near Baharistan, there was a level ground that was a parking lot. This is like about 7 in the morning, and it was a very young mullah ranting and raving, and all sorts of people were listening to him. And I said to Mr. Sabzavari, I can't believe, who is this guy, what's he saying? He said, well, an hour or so this guy will be arrested, but he's come from Iraq, and he's one of the, Khomeini disciples. And he's talking about Khomeini and Islamic government and so forth. And I said,
this is in what year?
This is 69, probably. And I feel like, Kamali, well, you know, let's face it, the Shah's regime isn't so hot. He said, no, it's awful. I said, well, do you think this is a violent opportunity? You know, if these guys get into power, I'll immigrate to America, he said. I'm scared to death of them. But he died before the revolution. But anyway, that's the story for tonight, huh? And we'll do Shiraz. I mean, Shiraz is another big chunk.
Okay. Thank you.